This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the important events of the week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Good to have you back, sir. From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran continue to heat up. This is a potentially explosive development in the Middle East as these two major powers vie for supremacy in the region. We spoke on Wednesday's program about the remarkable development since last Saturday when the Prime Minister of Lebanon suddenly resigned. This highlighted this battle taking place between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it really brings to mind some crucial biblical prophecies that we talk a lot about at the Trumpet. We're going to go for this story to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, so this situation between Iran and Saudi Arabia over Lebanon and Yemen continues to ratchet up. There was a couple of events that took place this week that indicate that this isn't going away anytime soon. Firstly, Saudi Arabia on Thursday issued a warning or a travel advisory to all of its citizens. And they said all of its citizens that wanted to travel to Lebanon or that were in Lebanon already, they basically said, don't do it. Then we had one of its allies in the Gulf there, Kuwait, the foreign ministry. They issued a similar order. And then just after that, Bahrain also issued a travel warning to Lebanon. So it's interesting, this move, whether it pertains or whether it forebodes war or not in Lebanon, we're not sure. But it's definitely something that some people are speculating, some commentators are speculating that because we have this Saudi Arabia telling its nationals to get out of the country, that this might make it seem that there is going to be some violent actions that take place, perhaps by Saudi Arabia. We'll see. So there was that action. Then also to try and put out some of these flames, we had the visit, a surprise visit by French President Emmanuel Macron to Saudi Arabia. He was down there to talk about the current situation involving Lebanon, it looks like he might be trying to play the middle ground between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but his historic position has been, France's historic position has definitely been to side with Lebanon, to side with Saudi Arabia in these kind of disputes. So he met with, on Thursday, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. He is the crown prince, and he is the mover and shaker in the kingdom right now. He is behind the current purge of a lot of more of the corrupt officials in Saudi Arabia. He's behind the move to modernize Saudi Arabia away from oil, behind the move to make Saudi Arabia more moderate, not following after political Islam and its ideals. And
yeah, so, really interesting development there in Saudi Arabia. What the moves that this man is doing? How long has he been in power? Because it seemed I'm probably not following what's going on there, but it seems like this happened very suddenly. The kind of moves that he's making.
Yeah, it was definitely. I'm just trying to jog my memory. I think it was definitely in the past year when he was made the crown prince. I believe it might have been his uncle. That was the former crown prince, but he's also the defense minister, a current defense minister as well. But yeah, he is, his dad is quite old, ailing in health. He is, this is the man that's going to plot Saudi Arabia's future. And it's interesting because he is a very strong leader. He's removing some people are looking at it in terms of, here's another strong man coming on the scene trying to consolidate his power. But a lot of the people he's removing from power weren't threats to his power at all. I think this is an actual honest attempt to try and rid the kingdom with some of the corruption that it's faced, to try and help his, at least most of the people, the populace would agree with the crown prince in this move. Nevertheless, this is who Mr. Macron met with on Thursday to discuss what's been taking place between Iran and Saudi Arabia, especially with what's been happening in Lebanon. Because if we remember from our Wednesday discussion, right now in Saudi Arabia, you have the former prime minister, Saad Hariri of Saudi Arabia, that did resign last Saturday. And they met together because, of course, Lebanon, that's a former French colony. France has been the most important foreign power, probably apart from the United States lately, but in its 50 or 60 year history, or in that time. And so they met together as well, which was indicative of where France looks to be siding in this current dispute.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if just looking at what the Saudi Crown Prince is doing, it does seem like that opens the door for Europe considerably. You said that Macron is kind of straddling the fence and he's kind of presenting himself as somewhat of a moderator, maybe, or trying a moderating force between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But you don't have anybody in Iran purging radicals, and they're going in the opposite direction in a lot of ways. For Saudi Arabia to be making these moves, and for Macron to be visiting there the way that he is so soon after all of this has happened, surprise visit, it really does underline this. The reality that you could see a much stronger relationship developing between Europe and Saudi Arabia, exactly as we've anticipated.
For sure. And I think the fact that Lebanon is involved is a pretty critical part of this, just because Lebanon, as we talked about on Wednesday, has a large Christian population. France as well is comes from that heredity or that religious background. It feels like they should be more involved. The fact that he met with the ex-prime minister to discuss what they could do to stabilize Lebanon, a Reuters piece came out and said that Macron reiterated the importance France attaches to Lebanon's stability, security, sovereignty, and integrity. Mm-hmm. If you're going to talk about the importance of Lebanon's sovereignty, you're obviously taking a swipe at Iran for what Iran is doing there. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if France comes down hard on this because it's involving Lebanon. We'll remember a few years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, they signed that huge deal. Basically, it was a military arms deal that was to go to the Lebanese army. It would be funded by Saudi Arabia, worth $3 billion, and then it would be made up, well, the purchases would have been of French aircraft, French other weapons and armaments. That was called off, about $1.5 billion into it, just because they saw that Hezbollah was taking over. Mm. And so, although going back to that time, you see that France is interested in strengthening the Lebanese state, but not if it's going to help out Iran in the long run. And so that's why he's there. To discuss this. And of course, this has far-reaching implications in biblical prophecy as that's concerned.
Before we get into that, just very briefly, it just makes me wonder how much was the groundwork laid in advance? Because it seems like Saudi Arabia, if they were the ones behind Hariri resigning and they encouraged this, it certainly looks that way. For France to respond this quickly and so favorably, it does seem like it certainly, if there was any kind of a gamble on Saudi Arabia's part in doing this, it seems like it's already paying off. But it seems like likelier that they had anticipated this, and maybe there were even some back channel discussions before this took place with France.
Yeah, I think that would happen with France. I think what's taking place in Saudi Arabia was probably discussed all the way back when President Trump visited for his first visit outside the country, outside the United States. And the kingdom was going this way, it seemed. But it's all been enacted overnight. It's called the Saturday Night Massacre. Mm-hmm. That's what they're calling it, Saturday night, what happened in Saudi Arabia. But then what's happening in Lebanon, Hariri, I mean, they're all parts of the same chessboard. Mm-hmm. Everything is related in the Middle East right now, and it's related to what Iran's doing. It's a response to what Iran's doing. And then Saudi Arabia's response has been a long time coming. Well, why has it taken this long to see? They've obviously known what Iran has been doing. Maybe they're going to see which way the Syrian civil war went. Mm. But now they see that the chips are down. They're enacting these reforms. They're bringing in their European allies. Mm-hmm. We had the Lebanese prime minister, ex-prime minister in Saudi Arabia, talking with the French, US, EU, and UK ambassadors all on Thursday. So it looks like Europe is, well, at least, who's Europe talking to right now? It's right. Definitely the Saudi, the Lebanese side rather than the Iranian side, which, again, that is what we expect. Bible prophecy talks about how there is going to be an alliance with Europe and these more moderate Sunni Islamic states, including Saudi Arabia, including Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And so we are expecting a change there. And maybe that change will be brought about because of strengthened European involvement. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens really soon, particularly concerning Europe's desire to put a cap on what Iran's doing right now with its ballistic missiles. Mm-hmm. The French president, he's going to talk to Iran. He's going to talk to them about, hey, stop doing what you're doing with your ballistic missiles, because they can reach Europe right now. And I think they are getting concerned about that. And if you're going to counter Iran in the Middle East, you've got to side up with Saudi Arabia.
Well, we're definitely going to be writing about this on thetrumpet.com. Anything that you could send people to very quickly before we move on to the next item?
Sure. A piece in 2014 written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, entitled Why You Must Watch Lebanon. Hmm. It goes into some of these details of Lebanon's history and also why Lebanon is kind of the linchpin for this Psalm 83 alliance.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. We're going to switch gears here now and turn to the horrific news out of Texas, another mass shooting, the deadliest in Texas's history. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
And not only was this mass shooting the deadliest in Texas history, it was also the third deadliest in United States history, with the Las Vegas shooting from last month coming in first place, and the Orlando nightclub shooting from last year coming in second place. So this has been just a horrible 18 months for mass shootings. A lot of new records been set. In this particular case, it was a mass shooting against a First Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. The shooting occurred around 11:20 a.m. local time. Locals were just there in the church celebrating their Sunday morning church service when a 26-year-old gunman walked in with an AR-15 and opened fire, killing 26 people, ranging from as young as 5 years old to as old as 72 years old, and wounding 20 more. The shooting stopped as soon as the man left the church. He was actually shot by a local man and National Rifle Association instructor who shot him as he left the church. And then the shooter got in his car to flee the scene. And then the NRA instructor found a local man with a truck who was willing to help chase him down. And then they chased him until his car crashed and he was declared dead on the scene. But people are still looking into his motive. Like I said, he just kind of came out of nowhere and started shooting. So far, investigations have turned up that he was a militant atheist who commonly railed against religious people on online forums, which they may think there's a connection there as to why he targeted a church. But he'd also escaped from a mental health facility in 2012 and was dishonorably discharged from the Air Force in 2014 for beating his wife and son. So he had a long history of domestic violence and some pretty serious mental health issues.
Now, those issues should have prevented these guns from being in his possession. Maybe you can just talk about how he ended up with such deadly weaponry.
That's absolutely right. The fact that he was convicted of domestic violence against his wife and child should have prevented him from getting a weapon such as this. There was actually some clerical error when the Air Force, after his court-martial, transferred the data over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that his name didn't carry over into the database. which has been something that's been highlighted before, just about some of like the vulnerabilities of trying to track people like this with there's such a huge nation and such a huge federal database that oftentimes it seems like a lot of these mass shooters had warning signs where they shouldn't have been able to purchase a weapon in the first place, but there was a clerical error that allowed them to do so.
So what lessons can we take from this? We've been talking about this in light of the Las Vegas shooting last month. The editor-in-chief of the Trumpet made some pretty strong points after that incident.
Right, and that is kind of the main one of the main lessons here is, I mean, you can talk about gun databases and trying to crack down on gun control, but America has been a nation of gun owners since the first colonist came over here in 1607. As a matter of fact, in the colonial period, you could even be fined by local law enforcement if you were caught on the road without carrying a gun because you had no means of protecting yourself. So gun ownership has dropped to historic lows. About 36% of Americans own a gun, which is lower than it's ever been. And so you're seeing something where gun ownership is going way down compared to history, but mass shootings are higher than they've ever been. So the trends are going in opposite direction. The fewer guns there are, the mass shootings there are. So you can't, as some media outlets are trying to do, kind of like label this as like, oh, well, these shootings happen because there are too many guns. These shootings are happening for another reason. And when you look at the history of mass shootings, about 50% of people who involved in mass shootings have a history, like this man did, of domestic violence. About 20% of them have a history, as this man did, with serious mental illness. And so the real question is why are interfamily violence and mental health problems so prevalent in America today? And that's the point that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, brings up in the November-December issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet in regards to the Las Vegas shooting, where he actually quotes a scripture from the prophet Isaiah, recorded in Isaiah 59, verses 6 and 7, where it says, "Their works are works of iniquity, and the acts of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, wasting and destruction are in their paths." So this is a description the prophet Isaiah is making about ancient Israel, where they didn't have guns. They were using knives and swords and bows and whatever weapons they had at the time to conduct a wave of mass violence very similar to the wave of violence you see in America today. And the cause is the same. There's a deterioration in family values. There's a mass turning away from God's laws regulating family values and regulating how people relate to their neighbor. That's caused a spiritual sickness to take root in American society that leads to a situation like we see right now, where 2017 has had more mass shootings than ever before in American history, even though gun ownership is at a historic low. As far as percentage of people who own a weapon.
Right. I guess there's just some people who own a whole lot of those weapons.
Yeah, like 3% of Americans own 50% of the guns. So there is a small minority that have just dozens and dozens and dozens, which is why gun sales are way up. Yeah, gun sales are at historic highs, even though gun ownership percents are at historic lows. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do want to encourage our listeners to go to find that article, Las Vegas Massacre, Problem, Cause, and Solution by Gerald Flory. He really does get into the spiritual cause, as Andrew was talking about there. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. If you find that in the show notes of this program, we'll provide the link there that makes it very easy to find that. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We'll go now to Asia. When Shinzo Abe won a snap election in October, it set the stage for him to potentially become Japan's longest-serving and most influential leader since World War II. And we've talked about how it also set him up to enact some nationalistic policies that he's been pushing for some time. Now we're seeing more evidence that Abe could be taking the situation into a more authoritarian direction still. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Shinzo Abe he's an intriguing individual. With his really fashionable Western-style suits and with his regular overtures to the American leadership, he appears at first glance to be very pro-Western and even quite deferential to Washington. But a closer look at him shows that Mr. Abe is a fiery Japanese nationalist, and he's determined to tighten his own grip on power in order to break Japan free of its dependence on the United States. The first indication of Abe's sort of strongman leanings came very early in his rule, all the way back in 2013. That was when he enacted the extremely controversial State Secret Act. And under this set of laws, civil servants found guilty of leaking government secrets can be imprisoned for up to 10 years. And then the law also says that journalists and other civilians who spill a state secret or who even ask about such information can face up to 5 years in prison. And the government's 19 different ministries are under no obligation to explain what topics they consider to be related to a state secret. So this means that basically an innocent civilian could be locked away for asking certain questions, even without understanding that they were asking about a state secret and never even finding out what their infraction was. So this means that whistleblowers within the government are very unlikely to help journalists, and journalists are unlikely to even inquire about sensitive subject matter. So the effect that this law has had on the Japanese press has been chilling. The year before Mr. Abe became Japan's leader, Japan ranked 11th in the World Press Freedom Index. So that's a very impressive ranking. But now, after 5 years of dozens of prominent journalists being removed from their posts at government request in many cases, and after most other journalists learning how to censor themselves very meticulously, at this point, Japan ranks 72nd on that list. So it's had a precipitous fall. So that was just a really worrying development there. And what many of these sacked anchors and commentators and reporters have in common is that they had been openly critical of Abe's efforts to make Japan more aggressive militarily. So basically, anyone who's been critical of his efforts to make Japan a full-fledged military once again can get removed from their post, and in some cases, they could be imprisoned. So there was another really worrying sign of Abe's authoritarian leanings, which was just this year on May 3rd. This happened on the 70th anniversary of the enactment of Japan's post-war pacifist constitution. And Abe proclaimed at that time that he will establish a new constitution by 2020. And the draft of the new document includes not just what we often talk about, which is his efforts to normalize and fully develop Japan's military, but it also includes that notorious ammunition that all aspiring authoritarians need, the emergency situation clause. So this clause says that if Japan is attacked, or if it suffers domestic unrest, or even if it's hit by a serious natural disaster, this clause would allow Abe to declare a state of emergency, and then without any deliberations or votes, his regime could issue orders that would have the power of national laws. And constitution experts across the board warn that this clause is alarmingly similar to the emergency decree clause that was part of Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution. That was the decree that, it was instrumental in the establishment of an unchallenged one-party Nazi state. So that's another really alarming development. And then in June, just a month after that, perhaps the most alarming sign yet of Abe's potential for authoritarianism arrived. That was when he pushed through a conspiracy bill that the Daily Beast said is, quote, straight out of Imperial Japan's darkest days. This bill is officially called the Law Regulating Preparing for Terrorism and Other Organized Crimes. And it says that if two or more individuals prepare to commit a crime, they can be penalized for it, even if they've not engaged in any criminal activity. Which sounds fine, but critics say that the vague wording, especially the words preparing and other, gives the government power to label nearly any civilian act as criminal. So the United Nations tried to get Abe to reconsider this law just because of the likelihood of it being abused by government officials, and he ignored all of those requests and rammed it through anyway. So there have been just a lot of sobering developments there, and to abandon Japan's pacifist constitution, Shinzo Abe still needs the approval of a majority of the Japanese public. He would have to get it passed in a national referendum. And so far, the public does remain divided on the issue. But with the media critics now subdued, and with government whistleblowers muzzled, and with these vague laws in place that let him easily slap the criminal label on adversaries and opponents, at this point, Shinzo Abe could use all of those instruments to very quickly have an unshackled and fully independent military to do his bidding.
That is amazing. And it's amazing to hear this in light of what we've been talking about in what's happening in China. We're actually putting together the coming edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, and we have quite a lot of material in here about the rise of strong men in countries all over the world. And as we are putting this all together, we've been focusing on some European nations, and we have a feature there by Jeremiah about China. But here we see this developing in Japan at the same time, and in a certain to a certain extent, you'd say that this is somewhat of a response to what's happening in China and these other areas. In all of these countries where you see people empowering these types of leaders, or you see leaders who are taking to themselves more and more of these kinds of powers, it is an effort to respond in a robust way to the rise of the threats that you see within the world that they feel like they have to address. They have to assert their own national interests out of their own protection. So just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, maybe you can just give a little bit of context and then some direction as to where to get more information.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the Bible prophecy talks quite extensively about the fact that in the time of the end, there will be a powerful block of Asian nations that will join together and play a major role in nuclear World War III. Scripture calls this Asian bloc the kings of the East. And it says that it will field an army of 200 million men, which is just a jaw-dropping number. You can see a lot of those facts and figures in Revelation 16, 12, and Revelation 9, 16. And it's interesting because such an immense force has never before existed in human history. But 21st century Asia is capable of fielding an army of that size, if you saw a lot of these nations pool their resources all together. And then Ezekiel 38 shows that Russia will be the lead nation in this end-time Asian bloc, but it also lists several specific countries called by their ancient names that will also be a part of it. And among them are Gomer and Togarma. And these are the ancestors of the modern Japanese people. So when we see Shinzo Abe becoming more authoritarian in order to make his nation more militaristic and more militarily capable, it just really appears that this is laying the groundwork for the fulfillment of that Kings of the East power bloc to come together.
All right, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. What happens if Europe falls apart? This seems like an increasingly likely possibility in light of the crises plaguing several European nations, and then on top of that, the dire political situation in Germany. Well, the German Defense Ministry has been planning for just such a prospect for some time, and recently details of a plan were leaked to a German newspaper, quite a fascinating picture of the way Germany sees the future and its place in it. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so first, I'm going to start with about the most basic thing possible with this new story. It exists. Mm-hmm. The plan exists. And that in itself is actually quite significant and pretty big news. So for 70 years, Germany's military has not been planning in this way. They've not been thinking of the future this way. They've not been, you know, what are this scenario? Because until this point, Germany's just really been in America's shadow. Planning for the future has been America's job. Germany's just a junior member of the NATO partnership and just kind of follows along. If you're following, you don't need a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the fact alone that Germany has a plan is quite significant. Geopolitical Futures wrote that the release of details about Germany's first national defense strategy in decades is a signal to the world that it doesn't intend to sit idle. So that time period is over. So we're starting to see a Germany that's emerging that's having to think for itself now. And not only that, it's having to think for itself, and the scenarios that it's coming up with, quite a few of them aren't great. It is having to prepare for some pretty grim futures. There are about 6 different scenarios that it looked at for what could happen over the next 20 years going on out to about 2040. And its kind of worst case scenario was America was gone from the picture and the European Union had completely fallen apart. There are other scenarios that saw, I don't think it directly named Russia, but basically Eastern European nations joining a different bloc. But it's noting that they're having to deal with some worst case scenarios. So now you're seeing Germany having to make those decisions, make that thinking. And it's just an indication of a different type of thinking that we have seen emerge from Germany over the last 2-3 years, but one that you didn't really see so much in the decades before that.
So this is the product of some planning for some years, and some of this has, even though it's only emerging now, this is a kind of long-standing plans that have been put in place. But how much more serious or how much more urgent are the needs for these kind of plans, considering just how much the world has changed just in the last year? When you think about the America's presence and the way that Europe is looking at America in light of a Trump presidency, you think of Brexit, and you think of all of the problems that have been besieging Europe increasingly over the last year. Now Germany's political problems. It seems like these plans are coming out at a really interesting time that we're being made aware of these things.
Right, absolutely. So this paper was released in February, but a lot of the large portions of it were written 2 years ago, which, you know, back then nobody thought Donald Trump was going to be U.S. president, etc. But even back then, Germany was kind of rattled. I think one of the big, you know, if you're trying to think back 2 years ago, a lot of the big push for this was you had the Ukraine crisis, you had an aggressive Russia on Germany's eastern border. NATO is looking shaky. They're not sure whether they can rely on NATO for their defense. Mr. Obama, we've talked about this before, but a lot of Mr. Trump's foreign policy is really a continuation of what Mr. Obama was doing in terms of this pivot to Asia, in terms of exhorting Europe to defend itself, telling Europe, well, we're not going to defend you for you. You've got to look after yourself. So they're seeing the world 2 years ago. They're making these decisions. And then those trends have continued and intensified and probably gone on a lot quicker than the German military was even expecting.
Right.
And so, yeah, if this document reflects their thinking largely as it was 2 years ago, then what is their thinking going to be like now? And it certainly means you've got to have Germany thinking, well, we need to be powerful in our own right if we can't rely on America to defend ourselves. Not only that, but we can't take the European Union for granted. We rely on the European Union. They've got to be thinking for our economy. We rely on European allies for our defense. So we've got to start thinking in terms of standing up for ourselves, in terms of what power can we use and bring to bear to keep the European Union together, perhaps even by more forceful means of persuasion. So it's definitely something that will really push Germany to increase its military power and just increase its activity as a quote-unquote normal nation, you know, trying to force its will on other countries in a way that until the last, say, 5-10 years or so, with the exception of the Balkans, you didn't really see Germany do. So just a big increase in German power.
Very quickly, Richard, we've got to move on, but more resources that would give someone bigger context, especially in terms of Bible prophecy.
I just really point our listeners to the cover article from the April 2014 Trumpet article called Germany's Urgent and Dangerous Military Decision. Just a really comprehensive overview of where this trend is leading and what's going to happen here as Germany changes its way of doing its military. It's by the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry. It goes through a lot of the prophecy behind that. And again, this is the turnaround of this paper for the German military grew out of exactly the same thinking that prompted Mr. Fleury to write that article just over 3 years ago. So it provides a great analysis of what we're seeing, and really what we're seeing in terms of this paper just confirms everything that he wrote in that article 3 years ago.
Thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a missile fired at Saudi Arabia's capital, the largest aerial military exercises in the world this year, developments within China's Air Force, and how many young people in the United States would prefer to live under socialism, communism, or even fascism. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We'll take another look at the situation between Saudi Arabia and Iran that we started talking about at the beginning of the program. Not long after Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned and took refuge in Saudi Arabia, there was a missile fired at the international airport in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Who fired it and what happened after that? These are both a matter of some intrigue. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this missile, it's one that reached the furthest into Saudi Arabian territory from the south. It was fired from Houthi territory. They are the Iranian-backed Shiite group in northern Yemen. Really just another battlefront of this proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And this was quite substantial because it traveled over 600 miles. That's a long way, and it was a ballistic missile. The U.S. military officials confirmed today that it was actually Iranian made, and it actually had Iranian markings on it as well. So it's not, they aren't even trying to hide the fact, although the Iranian government says they didn't do it. The Houthis, where else could they have got this technology from? Plus, it's got Iranian markings. So this was a substantial attack. While it was shot down, as we talked about, I think on Wednesday, by Patriot missiles, it does indicate the increased potential that the Houthis have to inflict damage on Saudi Arabia, and not just Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia's Gulf allies as well. Right after that missile was fired, an Iranian newspaper called the Kayhan, which apparently is one of Khamenei's, the Ayatollah's, mouthpieces, it had a headline, Ansar Allah's, which is the Houthis, missile launched at Riyadh, next target Dubai. And so it's not, they're not just after Saudi Arabia. They're interested in targeting the United Arab Emirates. This is Saudi Arabia's best partner in the GCC. Dubai is the largest city. And it looks like that city as well needs to be protected by Patriot missiles.
So really a picture of just how quickly and how radically this could escalate into something more serious than we see to this stage.
For sure. It indicates just how much Iran is able to mobilize its proxies to do a lot of its dirty work. I mean, we're talking about substantial explosions that could be, you know, hitting major cities, major international cities, with a lot of international traffic coming through these places. And so this is quite dangerous, what's happening in Yemen, because of what Hezbollah's doing. The Saudi crown prince, MBS, he said earlier this month, he said that Yemen is even much more dangerous than Lebanon because of its strategic location on the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, a major international shipping lane. So they're seeing the Houthi takeover of Yemen as being dangerous, not just for the ballistic missiles it can fire, but actually labeling the fact that, hey, it's a very strategic area. It's right on this main shipping artery that takes Indian Ocean material or Indian Ocean seaborne goods up into the Mediterranean. A lot of oil comes through here. It is dangerous that Iran has a foothold in this area for international shipping. And just reading that quote, it made me think a lot about what Mr. Gerald Fleury talked about back in 2015. Just when the Houthis looked like they were going to take over Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and everyone was saying that the Houthis, they're not really backed by Iran. They're totally acting independently of Iran. And Mr. Fleury, his headline for that piece was, Iran gets a stranglehold on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. How are they going to do that? by controlling Yemen, by controlling this Bab el-Mandeb Strait to international important strait for international shipping.
Well, we'll put the link to that article in the show notes. If you go onto thetrumpet.com and look at the hub for the Trumpet Hour, it also just makes me think, how much are these provocations that Iran is making against Saudi Arabia could actually be part of the push against Europe? When we were talking earlier about just the developing alliance between European nations and Saudi Arabia and here these other Gulf Cooperation Council nations that are being threatened by Iran's rise, the push is real. Iran doesn't seem to have any trouble or any compunction about really making itself a threat. And you have to think that Europe is certainly watching this, and Saudi Arabia is certainly trying to solicit their help as well. Thanks for that, Brent. The largest aerial military exercise in the world this year began this past Sunday. 11 days of fighter jets dogfighting and bombing each other's infrastructure, all in drill, of course. Dozens of aircraft, hundreds of sorties. Who's staging them? Who's participating? Very interesting answer to these questions, and we'll get them from Richard Palmer.
Well, these exercises were taking place in Israel, and one of the interesting things about it is this was the first time that the German Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, has flown in the skies of Israel for 100 years since World War I. It's a big milestone. It's the French are also there flying in the Israeli airspace for the first time since the Suez crisis. The countries taking part in the drills are the US, Greece, Poland, France, Germany, India, and Italy. A few of those have taken place, have taken part in these kind of drills before. There'll be around 100 planes. But what I think really stands out on that list is how many of them are European, especially France and Germany, but you've got several other European nations. Just a really important trend that we watch here, and that is Israel turning to Germany and Europe and relying on them for military help. So you're seeing them doing this exercise. There wasn't necessarily anything, at least in what's publicized with the exercises, in terms of plans for the future to do more together. But inviting an air force into your country, working together with them, that is laying some groundwork for the future. That is making it easier for those countries to be able to work together in the future. And it does demonstrate a certain amount of trust in those nations. So we're seeing now Israel looking more and more and having absolutely no apprehension, no reservation of any kind of bringing those nations in. Now, we watch this because Bible prophecy has a number of very specific prophecies on this subject. It says that Israel is going to turn to Europe for its defense. There are scriptures that talk just very directly about Israel inviting European forces in, European forces entering Israel, surrounding Jerusalem, not by force, but because they're invited there, presumably in some kind of peacekeeping capacity, because again, Israel just fundamentally trusts them. And then these same prophecies talk about these forces double-crossing Israel, using that position, using that trust that they've earned to turn against Israel and to take Jerusalem for themselves. Now, so we don't have time to get into all of those prophecies in this program, but we have a whole booklet on the subject that really goes into this in a lot of detail that's called Jerusalem in Prophecy. That's something that you can get on our website. Of course, we'll make it available in the show notes, but that will take you through all of those prophecies, the entering in peacefully and the prophecies about the double cross, and just show how they come really from throughout the Bible.
Thanks for that, Richard. We'll move on now. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. China has been growing in power in many ways recently. We mentioned this earlier in the context of developments in Japan. We're going to now get an update on some developments within the Chinese military, specifically its Air Force. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, one of the big goals for China's military has been developing more combat aircraft. And a new report says that at this point, the People's Liberation Army Air Force and its sister branch, the People's Liberation Army Naval Air Force, have 1,700 combat-ready warplanes. This is a report from the War is Boring defense blog, and it says that this huge aerial fleet is made up of fighters, bombers, and attack planes, and the only nation at this point that has a larger force of combat aircraft is the United States, which has about 3,400 active jets. The report points out that one thing that could be difficult for China's potential enemies is that China operates an unusually large number of different types of aircraft, many of which are not well known in the West. And it looks like many of these are based on Russian technology, which Moscow has, in most cases, transferred to China. So China has basically made clones of aircraft like the Soviet-era 216 Badger. The Chinese version of that is called the Xi'an H-6. And then there's also the MiG-19, the Chinese version of which is called the J-6. And then China also reverse-engineered Russia's MiG-21 into the very sturdy J-7. It looks like they've got about 400 of those in service now. And these don't have great radar, but they're real hot rods in terms of speed and maneuverability. And then China also has several home-designed models, like the Xingyang J-8, which can get up to a Mach 2.2, and the J-8-2. They've got about 150 of those now in service. And China also has more than 200 Xi'an JH-7s, and then also the Chengdu J-10 Vigorous Dragon, which is essentially China's answer to the F-16, a very highly maneuverable jet. China also has two pretty impressive types of stealth fighters, the Chengdu J-20 and the J-21, which are basically reverse-engineered American F-35s. And then in just last year, in 2016, China bought 24 of Russia's Su-35s, which are the most sophisticated and maneuverable jets that it has. So only about 38% of China's aircraft are fourth-generation fighters, which can theoretically hold their own against peers like the F-16 and the F-15, but it's still a very impressive and rapidly growing fleet. And China's ongoing military buildup with its jets and everything else is noteworthy because of Bible prophecies recorded in Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 11, also in Revelation, several chapters, Revelation 9 and 12 and other passages. And basically these prophecies say that in the end time, a powerful block of Asian nations will come together and they will be able to challenge a united European bloc at a time when no one else can, including the United States. And scripture makes clear that China will be a central part of this Eastern Bloc. There are a few different indications suggesting Chinese involvement in it. One is in Revelation 9:16, which says this Eastern army will have 200 million soldiers. And when you look at China's massive population of almost 1.4 billion, you see that that could really, you know, the Chinese would be able to lend a lot of troops to this army to get up to that unbelievable number. And then there's also Ezekiel 38:2, which talks about Magog being a part of this Asian bloc. And Magog is the ancient name for the area that now includes modern China. So when we see the Chinese military gearing up and developing hundreds and hundreds of warplanes, it is just a really sobering sign that the groundwork is being laid for these prophecies about the kings of the East superpower to be fulfilled. And I would just encourage listeners to check out our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which goes through all of these prophecies in great detail and explains how what we see happening in China today and in Russia today is leading to the fulfillment of some major things on the horizon.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. We're going to finish with quite an amazing political story out of the United States, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the nation that launched the most successful experiment in human history with government of the people, by the people, for the people. Young Americans don't seem particularly impressed. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, Tuesday was the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution when communism took over Russia. And so in, I guess, commemoration of that event, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation published a poll about what Americans believe about communism today. The poll included a sample size of some 2,000 people and found that amongst the millennials in the poll, 58% of them preferred to live under a socialist, communist, or fascist government compared to free market capitalism. And that, just breaking that down, it was about 44% said they would prefer socialism, 7% said they'd prefer communism, and 7% said they'd prefer fascism. compared to the 42% who thought that free market capitalism worked out all right for them. So the director...
So free market capitalist believers actually did... They were the largest plurality among all of those groups.
Second, it was 44 for socialism, 42 for second place.
Oh, that's
so Kevin came in second place, and then communism and fascism tied for third. This is something that the poll also brings out, that 67% of millennials didn't know what socialism was when they quizzed them for a definition. So that's kind of the main takeaway from the poll, is that some of these people have definitely have very far left ideas, but a good portion of them just don't know what the world they're talking about.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the that's what's coming out of our institutions today.
Right. The director had said this really is a systematic failure of the American education system to educate our young people about the history of communism, socialism, and fascism, and that's why we'll put in the show notes a popular reprint article of ours that comes from Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's book, The Former Prophets, that's entitled The Law of History. Mm-hmm. And this just basically goes through the Bible, especially the book of Judges, when Israel had a horrible track record of forgetting their history and just repeating past atrocities over and over and over, and just highlighting the importance of studying both biblical and secular history if you're going to learn the lessons that we need to learn about human nature and human government and what works and what doesn't.
It's absolutely appalling if you don't understand the history of this country and where it fits in the history of humankind, then you're really susceptible to falling into the exact same traps that mankind has fallen into time after time after time. And these young people, the way that they're thinking, we really do get a look at America's future. You can see it. You could see it in the presidential election last November, when we had an openly socialist candidate receive an enormous amount of support from the young people in the country. And you see the policies that even more mainstream candidates are taking in order to draw those people into their supporters. It's quite amazing to see this happening in the United States. I'm Joel Hilliker. Well, that'll do it for Trumpet Hour today. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to articles, the booklets, the literature that we discussed on the program today. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Grateful to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Richard L. Evans. Don't let life discourage you. Everyone who got where he is had to begin where he was. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.